I think the system is worse than it's ever been. I don't think there are any candidates in the field running for the highest office in the land who have a plan.
My name is Mark Joslin, and I will be your guide to learn more about author John Burke and his latest book, A Bold Plan for America. Hello, John.
Hello, Mark.
So I'd like you to talk us through a little bit about your background. You are a business leader, the CEO of Trek Bicycle. You are an author.
Yep.
And you've written a new book.
Yep.
Tell us more.
I grew up in Wisconsin. Two great parents. I've got two great kids, Richie and Courtney, married to an amazing wife, life partner, Tanya. And I'm the CEO of Trek today. My dad started Trek in 1976. I was lucky enough to graduate from school and come to work at Trek. I was a sales rep. I had, I think, 12 different states, and I drove my little Chevy Cavalier station wagon around the Rocky Mountains calling on small bike dealers. I learned the business there. I got a lucky break and came into Trek at an early age. I was able to run the sales business. And then all of a sudden, Trek went international. I was there for that. I've been here for 39 years. It's the only job I've ever had.
You decided to write a book, first about your father,
yeah,
on track, and then move to a different realm. Talk yeah. about that experience.
You know, my dad's 70th birthday party, he was an amazing man, and he was filled with content. But at his 70th birthday party, he said to me, tonight, I would like to make a number of remarks. I said, okay, Dad. And about a half an hour later, he said, you know, tonight I really do want to speak. When should I speak? And I said, well, it's your birthday party, but why don't we slot you in after dinner and before dessert? And he stood up, and out of his sport jacket, some yellow legal pads, some notes came out, and he talked for about a half an hour about his life, and it was unbelievable. And the next day, I headed off to Europe, and I got my computer out, and I wrote down everything I could remember about that speech because it was really good. And unfortunately, 3 years later, my dad went in for heart surgery to get a new valve, and things didn't turn out very well. And so he passed. And in that speech he gave when he was 70, he said, I have one last great thing to do. He says, I don't know what it is, but I've got one left. And so I titled the book, One Last Great Thing. And it's, you know, it's a story about, it's a great story about a father and a son, but, you know, that was an important moment for me, and I just wrote the book for my kids because I wanted them to be able to remember their grandfather. And some people read it and they said, you should turn this into a book. But it's called One Last Great Thing, and it's a short read, but it's a pretty good one.
So you were then inspired to turn your writing towards politics and,
yeah.
and the situation in the United States. Talk about the inspiration for that and your process.
You know, I was in the third grade, and my mother took my two older sisters and I to the East Coast. I think it was like spring break, and we went to Jamestown, and we went to Williamsburg, and we went to Washington, D.C., and we saw the Capitol and the White House, and I remember climbing up all the steps to the Washington Monument, and I fell in love with American history, and I'm like, this is an amazing country, and at a very early age, I was exposed to it. And not a very good student. I was your C student, following in my father's footsteps, except when it came to American history. If it was anything like that, I always got an A because I was really into it. And then I was at my son's graduation, Richie's graduation from Marquette. I think it was 2011, and David McCullough was the keynote speaker. Great author. I love to read. I love to read about history, and I've read most of his books. And the speech he gave to the graduates was on the importance of reading. And you'd think, wow, it's kind of a boring topic. It was spectacular. And I'll never forget the end. He gets to the end, and he kind of peers out. You know, here's this guy in his 80s, and he's got these bushy eyebrows. And he peers out over the audience, and he says, "And sometime, at some point, do something for your country." And it was in a frustrated tone. Here's this man who loved America. His life's work was America. And he's telling the generation, care about your country. And he's saying that to everybody in the audience, including me. And the country's been very good to me. And my personal feeling at that point in time is that the country's in decline. And so I thought, well, what can I do for my country? And, you know, I drove home to Madison that night. I said, you know, I like to write. I like to solve problems. I think America has a problem. So I started to research, you know, what really are the problems here? And I'm a solutions guy. I'm an optimist. I believe any problem can be solved if you get the right people in the room. And so I started to think it through. And so, you know, I've been working since then on, you know, how do you really turn America around? You know, what would you need to do? What are the problems that need to be addressed? What are those problems, and what are the solutions?
So if I bring us to present day,
yeah.
You have a new book. Why now for this message, a bold plan?
Yeah, I think America's in trouble. And I think the political process is in trouble as well. And I keep going, I go back to McCullough, do something for your country. You know, here we are. What can I do for the country? What can other people do for the country? What I think I can do for the country is I can educate America. I think there is a small percentage of the population who actually knows what the issues are and what solutions can be put in play to solve those problems. I think the system is worse than it's ever been. I don't think there are any candidates in the field running for the highest office in the land who have a plan. I've been sitting back, I watch, I listen, I read, and I think it's a joke. And it tears me apart. It's like here we have this incredible country, and we have people who are aspiring to the highest office in the land, and it's sound bites and it's name calling, and nobody's talking about the issues. So if nobody else has a plan, I'll have one. And, you know, I want to get a plan out there because, first of all, I want to educate the American citizens. I think that people need to be educated. I think it's a key part of our democracy. And the second thing is there's nobody else out there with a plan. So I'll put out a plan. I'll, you know, put this out there, and hopefully some of these ideas can resonate with the public. Hopefully these ideas can resonate with some of the candidates. But we've got serious problems in this country. We need serious people to debate the issues. We need serious people to come up with plans on how to attack these issues. Let's go. And I don't see us going. I see us, we're fumbling around.
So in the introduction, you outline 10 specific challenges that we face, many of which, as you said, are not being talked about by candidates or by anyone. So I want to take a minute and just provide that outline of those 10 issues. Have you comment on each?
Okay.
So the first is a mountain of debt.
I mean, as we talk, we're $33 trillion in debt. With the exception of World War II, from a percentage of GDP, the country's never been in this place. We have a mountain of debt. Our leaders keep piling up debt. Presidents don't think fiscal responsibility is important. They're more concerned about re-election and making people happy than they are in really being responsible for the performance of the country. And right now, between the Congress and the president, we've accumulated a $33 trillion debt, and nobody's talking about it in the campaign. So you can see in my book, I talk about it, and I talk about how you specifically deal with the debt.
Let's talk about the warming planet.
You know, the last time I checked, we only have one planet. And, you know, if you look around the world, we all breathe the same air. We all drink the same water. What happens in China matters to America. What happens in America impacts Europe. We're all connected here. The world is getting smaller. We only have one planet. America has led. In the past 200 years, America has led the world, and we're absent. And, you know, if you go out 50 years from now and you look back, the number one issue is going to be climate. And why are we going to wait 10 more years or 20 or 50? You know, we should, great companies, great organizations think long term. And we're missing this one. And it should be discussed in this campaign. The problem should be discussed along with the solutions.
The chances today of nuclear war are significantly higher than most are aware.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
You know, there's a group out there. It's called the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And there's, you know, a bunch of super smart people on this commission. And they have something called the Doomsday Clock. And they've had it for, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years. And they keep moving the clock based on what they think the threat level is. And the threat level is down to 1 minute to midnight. And, you know, every weapon that's ever been developed is used. And we're sitting here, and a bunch of really smart people are saying, you're closer to nuclear Armageddon than you ever have been. Issues not being discussed in the campaign, solutions aren't being discussed. If you take a look at the book, I talk about why people should be scared shitless. You should be. Your family, you, anybody you care about. And, you know, we're the leading nuclear superpower. We can help solve this issue, and we're sitting on the sidelines. And I think this is a great opportunity for American leadership. And my opinion, let's go.
We today have a political system that's awash in money.
Unbelievable. You know, you just take a look. Go to Georgia. You know, you've got Ralph Warnock, Herschel Walker, one Senate seat. They spent $425 million for one Senate seat. If you go to the election, Bush-Gore 2000, they spent $350 million for a whole presidential campaign. And the amount of money that's flying around in these elections, it's obscene. And people don't donate money because they want to be good Americans. They donate money as an investment. They give candidates money and they expect something in return. The way the system's supposed to work is one citizen, one vote. We all have the same power. And that's gone. It's, you can donate a lot of money, and when you do that, you get influence. You get phone calls returned, you get people to look at legislation, and it's crazy. And people really don't understand what's going on. And I address it in the book. I talk about campaign finance reform. We can deal with this. All these problems we have created, and they can all be solved. rather quickly.
Number five on the list is the military-industrial complex.
You know, there have been a lot of great speeches over the years. I mean, really amazing speeches. Kennedy's inaugural speech, Lincoln at Gettysburg. But then you got Eisenhower's farewell address. You know, and people, some people talk about it. It's a classic. And basically what Eisenhower said is, listen, we're in a different space right now, and it's worrisome to somebody who is a general. And what he's warning against is a military-industrial complex where the military grows and it gains all this influence and it uses this influence to continue to grow itself. The power shifts from the citizens to the military. And we spend $800 billion a year on our military. We spend more on our military than the next 10 nations combined. We have roughly 4% of the population, and we spend 35, 38% of the global military spend. It's crazy. And we don't talk about it in the campaigns. In fact, if you come out and you say, we could spend less on the military, somebody will say, you're a wimp, you're a loser, you're not strong. And we've gotten ourselves into this name-calling environment instead of focusing on facts. And successful organizations focus on facts.
Another example of spending, we have a very expensive healthcare system, but not maybe the results that would correspond with that. Talk about healthcare.
Well, in this country, we spend almost twice as much on GDP as any other country, and we get almost the worst results. We're 55th out of 57 Western countries. If you were a business, you would be fired. If you were a sports team, you would be fired. And this isn't a one-year track record. Like, we've been in last place for 20 years, and we just keep running the same play, and it gets back to the military-industrial complex. We have a healthcare-industrial complex. There's so much money in this game, and there's so much outside money that's being spent on politicians to keep the rigged game the same, and the loser is the American citizen. If you live in Italy, you will live 7 years longer than if you live in the United States. It's crazy. But, and I spent a lot of time on it in the book, is this can be solved. Like, there is an optimistic view of this, and Americans can live longer, can be healthier, if we had a change in the way the government runs the healthcare system.
You address a number of areas of legislation. Today we have ineffective gun laws.
I mean, it's crazy. You know, and here's the thing is, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I'm just an independent. You know, it's like, I just look at the facts, and then I make up my mind. But if you step back and you look at the facts are that the Constitution does not say that you have a right to keep and bear arms. That doesn't say that. There's all these words that people forget, and what they forget is a militia has the right to keep and bear arms. And our gun laws produce 45,000 dead people a year, 100,000 people who have been shot and they don't die. And there's a million women alive in America today who have been shot at by a partner. And this just goes on year after year. I can tell you, next year there's going to be another 45,000 people who are going to die. That's what's going to happen. And our leaders do nothing except go to funerals and pray for people and shed a few tears. And, you know, it's like one victim's mother said, I don't want any more prayers. Change the damn laws. And, you know, it's not, you know, when a guy sits in a hotel room over a concert venue in Vegas And he brings out a submachine gun and he mows down 56 people. He's not picking out Republicans or Democrats. He's killing Americans. And when somebody walks into a school, they're not shooting, you know, the kids of Republicans or Democrats. They're killing innocent children. And the nonsense that goes on right now, I have a friend who's a school teacher in Colorado, and they have lockdown training, and they give you a lockdown kit. You know, and the kit's this can that you can use, you know, it's got lollipops in it, and it's got, you know, tissues, and then you can use the can for a toilet. Imagine how exciting that is when you go for your teacher's training and you get the lockdown training. I mean, it's absurd. And we keep doing this because there's a small group of Americans who have a lobbying group, and 82% of Americans want the gun laws to change, and we don't have the will or the courage to get this done. And people in this country, the government stood up and they said, in the 60s, they said, we have all these citizens dying of smoking. And they said, we're going to do something about it. And then they said in the 80s, after there were enough people who were killed by drunk drivers, there was a group of women who stood up and they said, this is nonsense. And they formed Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They did something about it. And now you have some groups who are coming together. Sandy Hook Promise, you've had some women's groups. But Americans should be outraged. And all we have to do, this only exists in one country in the world. It's ours. And it doesn't need to be that way. And I go through this in the book, is there's, here's the problem, and here are the solutions. Like, we can solve this problem quick. And we can save all these lives. We can save a ton of money. And, you know, most of all, we can save people's lives and people's futures.
Today we have a prison system
That's
overrun.
Yep.
Talk about that.
The numbers are staggering. You know, nobody gets elected in the United States by saying, we should have shorter sentences. And where we've come to is, in the United States, per 100,000 people, we have like 600 plus people in jail for 100,000 citizens. And you go, well, is that high or low? Well, if you go to Russia, the number's like 325. It's half what it is in the United States. If you go to the UK, it's like 150. It's one quarter. If you go to Germany, it's like 75. If you go to Japan, it's like 33. It's 1/20th of what it is in the United States. We have all these human beings locked in cages. And we're paying a ton of money to do this too. We have a $33 trillion deficit. And we also have a shortage of workers for jobs. And there's a lot of people who are in jail, nonviolent people. And I think we ought to take a look at it and say, what changes could we make here to reduce the prison population, to rehabilitate lives, to grow the economy, and to cut our expenses so we can bring the deficit down?
So another area of spend is Social Security. And today, that's a program that is not on track to be financially viable,
Even
by 2035. Talk about Social Security.
Well, I mean, how many people are interested in Social Security? Everybody is. You know, it's one of the great programs that was developed. You know, back in the 30s, President Roosevelt, you know, we've got people, you know, here's Social Security that provides an income, you know, in your later years. It also takes care of people who can't help themselves. People think it's just for old people. No, it's bigger than that. And the Social Security Trust Fund is running out of money. And by 2035, won't be able to pay what it's due. Let's fix the problem. There are easy solutions to this problem. A program that has meant so much to so many people. Our leaders are sitting there and just watching a train wreck. Instead of working together, saying, here's the problem, here's all the solutions, let's fix it. It can be done.
The 10th that we outline is the tax code. Very complicated, thousands of pages, U.S. tax code.
It's a joke. You know, there ranges on what you want to include in the tax code. It's somewhere between 6,500 pages and 70,000 pages, but nobody knows what's in the tax code. You hire H&R Block, or you hire some. It's so freaking complicated, you have to hire someone. And, you know, politicians use the tax code to put in favors for other people. And, you know, you're at a point in time where the richest people today pay a lower percentage of overall tax than the poorest people. And we're $33 trillion in debt. And there's so much money in the political system that nobody's incentivized to change the tax system. So here's how you win an election in America. The way you win an election is you go, I will cut your taxes and I will get rid of all the wasteful government spending. And what happens is they cut the taxes and nobody ever cuts the wasteful government spending. And my point is how many Americans would like a tax code that is 10 pages or less? I mean, I'll give you two options. You can have a 6,500-page tax code or 10 pages. What do you want? Okay, well, we get 6,500. I guarantee you 99% of people will take 10 pages. You can produce a 10-page tax code that everybody would understand, that could be very fair, and yet we fail to do that. Our leaders put their political careers and paying off their sponsors ahead of what's in the best long-term interest of the United States.
You've outlined these problems, these Yep. opportunities, and more importantly, you've provided specific examples, actions that could be taken. Your primary goal is to educate people. Talk more about that.
You know, it frustrates me because here we are in a presidential campaign and none of the candidates are talking about the real issues. And the reason why they don't talk about the real issues is the way you win is you just call your opponent an idiot. You say as little as possible and you call your opponent an idiot. And I think we're in this doom loop where politicians, fueled by a ton of money, just dumb down the American public. And so we're left with a dysfunctional society and a dysfunctional government. And I think that needs to change. And I think we need to start focusing on the facts. And we need to start focusing on our biggest problems and what are the solutions. I had a really smart friend of mine. He came up to me and he goes, you know, I read one of your books. And he goes, I am a staunch Republican and I agree with everything in the book. He goes, if you put a bunch of smart people in a room and you write down all the facts on a board, 90% of them will come to the same conclusion. And I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. I think the missing piece of the puzzle is Americans don't understand the issues and they don't understand the facts. That's why I wrote the book. It's 175 pages. It's a fun read. There's a lot of graphs. There's a lot of facts. Educate yourself. If we have developed, everybody likes to focus on how horrible our leaders are. And they're not bad people. They're just in a bad system. And I would agree, I would give them a very low score as leaders. But the other problem that we have is the citizenry in the United States. And our citizens are not well educated. So my point is, I'm tired of watching this. I want to actually do something about it. So I want to help people get educated on our biggest challenges and our biggest, and how you can solve those. What are the solutions to these big challenges? And when citizens get more educated, they can be more demanding of candidates. The level of discourse, the level of conversation in society with the candidates in campaigns will rise, and I think that American politics will rise along with it.
So we're going to use this podcast to explore all of what you just talked about. We'll talk about the role of leaders, and you've built a scorecard. We'll talk about the role of citizens and what we can do. The book is key. If people would like a copy of the book, they can download it for free. They can visit aboldplan.com. Also, we'll use this podcast, and people can share the podcast with others as well.
That's the key, is sharing the information. It's not a Republican view. It's not a Democratic view. It's an American view. It's like, forget about names and parties and just focus on, we're all on the same team. And the team is called the United States. We're all so lucky to be citizens of the greatest country that's ever existed. But we need to be worthy of the title, citizen of the United States. And one of the ways that we can be worthy of the title is get educated about the greatest challenges we have and what those solutions are.
For sources and citations, please see A Bold Plan for America by John Burke.